Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Patuk, your host today. Hello to you, our listener, and thanks for joining us. We've got two very different features for you today on Local Talk. In the first half of the show, we'll be visiting the Mucky Duck British Pub on South Duff in Ames, which has just recently, after going through all the necessary regulatory processes, started allowing dog owners to bring their dogs onto the pub's outdoor patio. Then, in the second half of the show, there'll be a discussion of literacy issues with the Ames Progressive Alliance and their guest, the Vice President of Decoding Dyslexia, which is an organization of parents and volunteers concerned about issues of reading
difficulty.
But first to the Mucky Duck. In addition to enjoying your fish and chips on the patio with your faithful dog at your side, you can also, if you wish, tie up your horse at the hitching rail outside the pub. And if you've ever wondered whether British food deserves its reputation of being bland and, well, bad, and if not, where that slander came from, stay with us and you can hear from Marcus Johnson, the owner of the Mucky Duck, who'll give his views on that topic. To start with, let's hear what happened when my husband and I took our own dog, Emma, a big Newfoundland, out for lunch on the patio of the Mucky Duck.
That is that a Newfoundland?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, my God, it's a gorgeous dog.
Yeah, they are lovely.
Let's try to get some shade for the big boy.
She's a girl.
She's a girl.
Petite. She's very petite for her size. Yeah, this is a shady spot here, and we can definitely, maybe I can put up another umbrella right there and angle it so we can get a little bit more shade for her, okay?
Oh, super, thank you.
Do you guys need a drink menu? Oh,
yeah, I know what I want.
Cider.
Oh, the Manger cider is on tap. The Irish cider. You want a pint of that or a 20 ounce?
20 ounce.
Okay, sir, for you.
Oh, super. Well, I see you've got your dog here.
We do.
On the patio.
It's hello. Super,
hello, hello. Yeah, I'm with KHOI Radio. It's a local community radio station.
It's nice to meet you. We're from New Jersey. This is Ellie. And we're taking her on a road trip for a month. And we're glad to find this place to eat and hang out. We're very grateful.
Right, yes. When you've got a dog on the road, they love to get out of the car.
Yes.
So you're very glad to see this place.
And they're super friendly and welcoming, and it's great.
So you've been here before?
No, we've never. We just landed in Iowa today.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, we left New Jersey on Wednesday.
Okay. Well, we just came by on the off chance with our dog in case there was someone here I could talk to. And just then you were arriving, so that was handy.
You've got a wonderful dog, a really wonderful dog. So do you live here?
Yes, yes.
So do you eat here frequently with your dog?
I don't think Marcus has had this open for the dogs, but I eat here frequently. Yeah, I like it. Since I'm British in origin anyway, so.
So how long have you been here?
Oh, since 1968. Long time.
So is the food authentically British?
I see you brought your dog here to the Mucky Duck patio. Have you been here before?
Oh, yes, many times.
Okay. So it's a big attraction for you, having the patio where you can bring your dog, is it?
This is the first time he's been here, but I've been here many times, yes.
Oh, okay. So he's getting kind of excited because he sees a couple of other dogs here.
Yeah. He will calm down eventually.
he could probably walk over and greet my dog, actually.
And that one
mine's the big Newfie there.
Newfie? Awesome.
Shall I take him over then?
You sure can. That's me. Jax, you'd be good. Cool.
You guys have anything else?
Nope. Not right now. Probably going to order some food eventually. So.
Yeah.
He's little.
Well, the two dogs greeted one another. The third dog is a little shy of other dogs, so didn't greet him.
Great.
Do you like the food here?
I do, very much. I'm especially a big fan of the fish and chips.
As you can hear in that clip, dogs, as usual, can help you start conversations with people you don't know, especially if you all turn out to be dog lovers. And now let's hear what Marcus Johnson, the owner of the Mucky Duck Pub, has to say about his new venture. My guest is Marcus Johnson of the Mucky Duck Pub in Ames, which is out on South Duff in Ames.
Good morning, Kay. It's a pleasure to be here with you again.
Yeah, and we've come to talk about a specifically new thing you've got at the pub, And that is, you allow dogs on the terrace. Where did you get this idea from?
Well, you know, being an Englishman, dogs are very common over there. Actually, once one of the things my American wife noticed the first time we traveled over there together was just how prolific dogs are.
They right.
Are
just, well, you see them more. There's probably just as many dogs in this country, but you don't see them around.
You don't.
As much.
People keep them locked up in cages
exactly.
at home because yes. they can't take them anywhere.
Yes, yeah. exactly. Yeah.
So basically, to me, it makes sense for an English pub to, you know, have dogs because that's what we do in England. And of course, you know, being a pub owner with a patio, over the last you know few years, I would get people coming up to me and saying, you know, do you mind if we have our dog on the patio? Because most people are not aware of the rules. And unfortunately, I was having to say, I'm sorry, but you know the law doesn't allow for that at this time. I mean, you can't bring your dog on the patio, and it was sad and frustrating, and people don't understand. And I thought, you know, this needs to change. And you know, I've been aware of more relaxed rules in other states. I was just in Colorado, in Boulder, for example. My gosh, there's dogs everywhere in that town.
Mm-hmm.
And in you know, California, other states, other areas of the country are moving, you know, towards relaxing those rules. And it hadn't happened in Iowa yet, and so I thought it was something that I needed to look into.
And so there were various regulations you had to comply with before you could do this, right?
Yeah, well, as it stood a year ago, there was no possibility of a restaurant with a patio allowing dogs on the patio. So
In Iowa,
mm-hmm. yeah. And so what I needed to do was to approach the Department of Health, the State Department of Health in Des Moines, and apply for a variance to be excused from those certain sets of rules. And that's that was the beginning of that process.
And those rules, can you just briefly go over them? I mean, you had to comply with certain things. I noticed the dogs, no way they're allowed to enter through the pub itself, have to come round the side.
Yeah, well, the rules kind of, we sort of iterated towards. We you know, initially came up with those rules ourselves.
Oh, you do those yourself?
Yeah, because there was no precedence. So there, you know, the rules stated that there was to be no dogs. And so there was no need to have any rules about it because that was it. Rule number one, no dogs. So in order to obtain a variance to allow dogs onto our patio, I actually came up with you know, rules number 2, 3, 4, 5, which said if you do allow dogs, then, you know, this is what the rules are going to be. And then we iterated a couple of times between myself and the state and came up with something that was they accepted. And there was a few other things that I needed to do that the state required. One of them was to, you know, show that there was no legal problem in terms of people's rights being, you know, compromised. You know, people are afraid of dogs, and so I actually had to hire an attorney to do some research on that and write a letter, which is, you know, not cheap. It cost me quite a bit of money for him to do that, and he came up with a, you know, a statement, you know, saying that, you know, for the most part, people have a choice. You know, they can go to the Mucky Duck or they can go somewhere else, and so
or they can go inside or outside.
Yeah, and they can go inside or outside. So that was the basis mm-hmm. of that mm-hmm. Written document, and that was one of the, you know, crucial parts of my application for that variance. So,
mm-hmm. Mm. Now, how long have you been allowing dogs on the patio now?
Well, I think it got approved, I think, in late July or maybe August, but I didn't have all the necessary things in place until, you know, late August, early September.
Okay, so it's very, very brief.
It's very brief, yeah. Yeah. You know, some of the other, there's a lot of requirements for signage and also training. My staff have to all be trained to the Safe Serve certification.
So they can't pat the dogs and serve the food.
Absolutely not. Yeah. That was one of the rules the state was very mm-hmm. clear on. People that work at the pub cannot touch the animals, and that's you know, that's important. So I have to make sure my staff all know that. It's very tempting sometimes.
Right. Well, I think they'd have to go and wash their hands, I suppose.
Have to go and wash their hands. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was there with my dog, who's a big dog, the other day, and there were two other dogs there, and they were all very well behaved.
They were very well behaved, actually. Yes.
And has that been the experience so far, that the dogs are good citizens, good canine citizens?
So far, we have not had any trouble. And, so far, we have not had any trouble. We have strict rules about that, too. You know, we won't tolerate any kind of aggressive behavior or barking. You know, mm-hmm. the odd bark is okay, but if there's...
Right, they should just lie down and mind their manners.
They should lie down and mind their manners. And mm-hmm. And unfortunately, if they can't do that, then they have to leave.
Yeah, well, this, you know, you started, Marcus, by mentioning that you don't see dogs around here much, and you do see them everywhere in England. And nobody, including Americans, nobody seems bothered by the English dogs they see everywhere. Because they are pretty well behaved.
Yeah.
They're well trained. They're used to being out with people. They're not shut up at home all day alone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people are just used to it. So the dogs are socialized. So it seems a bit of a vicious circle to me. If dogs are at home all the time and they don't get out and go around and meet people and meet other dogs, they become not good citizens.
They become not good citizens. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course there's a dog park here now, which helps dogs a lot. And it's quite noticeable, actually, the way the dogs have the behavior at the dog park has improved since it first opened.
Yeah.
The dogs have got used to one another. And
yeah, yeah.
So, you're contributing to canine welfare in this town, probably.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that I actually have people bringing their dogs to the pub specifically for socialization skills. And I think that's quite interesting, you know. Luckily, they're, you know, obviously don't have major problems, otherwise they wouldn't bring them there. But I think a lot of people have said, yeah, we just wanted to bring little Charlie to the Mucky Duck, just to get him out and to meet some other dogs, which is great. You know, it's cool. Yeah,
right.
As long as it works, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, one of the ladies I was talking to when I was there with her dog, they were on a road trip. And, you know, when you're on a road trip with a dog, you look at, I mean, you plan ahead to places, you know, the hotels, motels that were allowed dogs, and to some extent, obviously, restaurants, because you don't want your dog to be shut up in the car all the time. You've got to get your dog out of the car, and the more you can. So that's how that landed up in the Mucky Duck. They must have researched it or something.
Yeah, that's right. And there are various websites available that appeal to travelers that show these locations and places. And as of a few months ago, there was nowhere in Iowa you could stop and have a bite, which, yeah, creates a big dilemma. If you're traveling and it's the summertime, you know, you can't leave your dog in the car. So what do you do?
Yeah. And now you also have a horse hitching rail.
Yes, we have a horse hitching rail.
And one horse has visited, I believe.
Yeah, one horse has visited so far. And I think that some of my staff think I'm completely crazy putting that up. But
it's fun.
It's just a bit of fun. And you know, we're not going to have hundreds of horses at the pub.
But if someone does want to ride their horse out to the Mucky Duck over the fields,
yes,
they've got somewhere to tie up their horse while they have a beer.
To come in, yeah. And of course, we don't encourage having, you know, more than one beer if they're going to ride home. But
well, you're probably, I don't know, I'm not really a horsewoman, but you're probably safer on the back of a horse if you've been drinking than you are behind the wheel of a car, because the horse isn't drunk.
The horse isn't drunk, no. But horses are dangerous.
In fact, you know, I remember when it must have been about 50 years ago, or maybe even more, when the drinking laws the testing for drunk driving in Britain became much stricter than it had been. Mm-hmm. And it was actually, that was a very good thing for pub life, because most of the pubs became much more like restaurants. But one of the things that was I suppose a passing fad, you'd see pictures in the paper of people riding their horses to pubs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, somewhere where I'm from, Grafham in West Sussex, you know, pretty much everybody has a horse in that area. You know, we had horses, my neighbors had horses, so that's entirely feasible.
Well, in addition to the new patio, the new rule on the patio where you can take your dog and the hitching post, you've got another something that's pretty new. That's a mobile food truck.
Yeah.
Mobile mallard.
The mobile mallard, yeah, keeping in the animal theme. That's pretty much preoccupied my summer building this food truck. It's big. It's probably one of the biggest food trucks that are around that I've seen anyway. It's green. It's got duck prints down the side.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah.
And we are excited to be getting it out, actually, and we've done a few events so far. The Irish Festival in Waterloo, and we were at Snooze Hill Winery and Torrent Brewing Company, and we're just planning a whole bunch more events. And yeah, very, very excited to.
Do you have the whole menu on the food truck?
It varies. It depends on which, what we're doing, really. So for, you know, for Schnitzel, for example, we just did burgers and fish.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing the World Food Festival this coming weekend. I think we're going to do bangers and mash, fish and chips, sticky mm-hmm. toffee pudding for that. So really it depends. You know, if it's a small event, we'll just do a, you know, have a very limited selection. Mm-hmm. But bigger events, we will have more.
Okay.
So not the full menu, but some subset.
Now, talking of menus, I've become aware when I talk to people about the Mucky Duck or British food or food and the fact that I'm British, I'm surprised how frequently this comes up. Is British food bad? If it's not, where do people get the idea that it is? Did it used to be bad? And has it stopped being bad? Anyway, any thoughts on that whole area?
Yeah, I've certainly come across this before. Actually, I was down at the Renaissance Fair a few years ago vending food, and there was this quite rude couple walked past and jeered something towards our direction about British food tasting like, you know.
not tasting
not
good.
Very nice.
You mustn't say that on the air.
Mustn't say that on the air, so I won't say any rude words. But so, you know, most of the time people aren't as rude as that, but there is this perception that British food is stodgy and bland.
That's the word, bland.
Bland, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, no, there's not a dentist in this town, but I was at the dentist. You know, you got at a certain disadvantage with the dentist because they've got a drill in your mouth and you can't put back. He came out with this, British food is bland. And I said, when I had a chance, well, you know, British people do eat a lot of curries, and he didn't know what curries were. So that's so much for his opinion. I mean,
yeah.
If he didn't know what curries were, he didn't really know anything about British food.
Yeah, we eat a lot of curry. We spice it up. We eat very spicy food. Most
yeah,
Brits.
Yeah, but I mean, traditional, the curry thing, although it's everywhere, and as you say, it's almost considered a British dish now, but traditional British food, very good ingredients, simply cooked.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think this perception that British food is bad, I think it's a post-war thing, a 50s thing. Mm. When, you know, there was still rationing, food was short. I think that's the origin of it. Mm. Also, another thing I think maybe is that British people don't tend to go out to restaurants to eat British food.
No,
they
don't.
They go to an Italian restaurant or an Indian restaurant or whatever. And, I mean, this is an old thing now, but British restaurants, they were tended to be for really cheap places with really low price.
Yeah.
You know, for people that had to eat something and wanted to do it at a very low price.
Right.
And they were, and that again was a post-war thing.
Yeah. Well, the kind of transport calf.
Exactly.
Which is
baked beans on toast.
Baked beans on toast.
Yeah, and you know, white bread.
Yeah. That translates to truck stop, by the way.
Yeah. But I think that's by the board, actually.
Well, I challenge anyone to, the meal that my mum would make every Sunday, the traditional Sunday roast.
Delicious.
It might be lamb, beef, pork. 3-4 different vegetables, roast potatoes, Yorkshire puddings, gravy. I mean, that
superb.
There's nothing bland about that. That is still one of my favorite meals.
Right, that's the thing. There was always very good cooking in British homes. But,
oh, very good. Yeah.
But if you stopped at a restaurant or cafe to eat food and it was British food, it probably wasn't good for at a certain period in history.
Yeah. I think 20, 30 years ago, pub food was sometimes not all that great.
Oh, it was like little frozen things.
Yeah, they would use frozen
little meat pies
and stuff like that. Yeah. But I got a little funny story. I used to, when I was going to the University of Surrey, I used to drive past this pub every day, and there was a sign out the front. It said traditional English pub, warm beer, cold food, lousy service.
Well, perhaps we should end this conversation and say you'll get good service and excellent food at the Mucky Duck.
You get good service.
And you can take your dog.
But let me just, I think the pub in England or the UK has changed actually over the last couple of decades. And in many cases, the kitchens are franchised out now to quite, you know, upscale restaurants. So, for example, you could be in the middle of some tiny village somewhere where, you know, 30 years ago, there'd be a couple of old guys sitting at the bar smoking and drinking beer and, you know, frozen pizza maybe. But now the whole kitchen will be franchised out by a high-end Thai or Indian or Italian restaurant, and you'll look at the parking lot and it's full of, you know, BMWs and Mercedes. And that's been a change I've noticed over the last couple of decades.
Right, yeah, actually, and that brings up another thing. Restaurants do tend to be more standardized in America, I think. You know, there's these franchises, whereas these little restaurants that I was talking about, these little, you know, cafes, they were all mom and pop organizations. There wasn't a sort of standardized McDonald's or Olive Garden or whatever it was, you know. There is, as you say, we still
have that edge, You know, the old saying that British are a nation of shopkeepers. We're a nation of shopkeepers and small restaurant operators. I'll just add that bit to it.
Okay. Well, anything else to add for potential dog lovers at the Mucky Duck?
No, just bring your dogs down. I think it's lovely for the animals and people are getting on. You know, it gives people a talking point.
It does.
And that's lovely. And that really, you know, that's the kind of atmosphere we've always had at the pub inside. And so it's nice to see that outside now with the dog owners. So bring your dogs, bring your horse if you like. Keep an eye out for the mobile mallard. We'll be flying around your neighborhood sometime soon.
Thank you, Marcus. Hey. I've been talking to Marcus Johnson of the Mucky Duck Pub, which is on South Duff.
Thank you, Kay.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm your host, Kay Potok. Now, I'm happy to welcome Anne Kinzel and Victoria Shabinsky, members of the Ames Progressive Alliance, who've joined us together with a special guest for their regular monthly broadcast on progressive issues here in Ames. Welcome to you all. Would you like to start by introducing your guest and today's topic?
Oh, good morning, everybody. Today we're going to welcome Helen Blitvich. We're so glad to have Helen here as we continue the Literacy Challenges conversation started early this month at our Ames Progressive Alliance Progressive Pints event at the Alluvial Brewery. Progressive Pints is Ames Progressive Alliance monthly community event where we hold conversations in town on issues that are important to our community. Last month, we focused on disability issues, and in August, we discussed issues of race and class with ISU students and members of the Ames community. Today, we want to discuss how literacy issues affect children and families and the steps that parents and children have to go through on their school journey to literacy. So I'd like to introduce our guest, Helen Blitvich, who is going to talk about her family's experience with my broadcast partner, Victoria Shabinsky.
Good morning, and thank you so much, Helen, for being with us this morning. So let's get going, because I know there's a lot to talk about. Let's start out with maybe you could tell us a bit about how your family was introduced to dyslexia.
Well, I guess it was probably back in 2008, my eldest son was struggling with reading in kindergarten and continued to struggle until he was in second grade. And we'd ask questions about it as things went on, but it was just like, you know, just keep reading, he's a boy, just encourage him to read. And he was becoming more frustrated by the time, towards the end of second grade. And so I'd sort of probed a little bit more, and then it was suggested that we get him tested. At the time, the teachers, I guess, couldn't say what for, but that we should go and see one of the Dr. Lewicker here in town and have him tested, and discovered that he was dyslexic. And so then, yeah, we sort of went from there thinking, well, that's great. We have a diagnosis now. Yeah.
Well, maybe we should explain what dyslexia is.
So dyslexia it's a specific learning disability, and it's sort of characterized by difficulty with reading, writing, and spelling. It's not related to intelligence, and it's just sort of a struggling with reading, but it's also not related to instruction as well. Like, if they might be receiving good instruction, but they still are having difficulties with reading.
So he was diagnosed, and he was given the label of dyslexia, and then what happened? Did his instruction?
No. So I would like to have, you know, when we got that, I was relieved. I was like, yay, you know, we've been doing all the right things. And so I went back to the school and said, you know, we've got this diagnosis. I think we need to probe a little bit further. Maybe we can look into special education. And so we did that, and he was evaluated. But because he wasn't discrepant enough from his peers, he wasn't eligible for special education. So then it was like, so what do we do now? And there really wasn't a lot. There's support in the classroom, but not really specific instruction for these kids, you know, in the general ed in classroom.
So, Helen, I just want to ask, so he received a specific diagnosis of dyslexia, mm-hmm. was not eligible for special education, and that was sort of the extent of what the schools had to say?
Well, I mean, they were supportive, but they didn't have any specific programs in place to help students with dyslexia. You know, you could get pulled out into small group instruction and things like that to help you, but it wasn't really specific for students with dyslexia.
So the next step was you found some assistance for him.
So I did a lot of reading about it. I thought, surely there's something that we can do. There's something that can help kids with dyslexia. And I went on the internet and I did a lot of work. I even went and did a course out in Colorado. And in the end, it basically came down to doing private tutoring is what we needed to do, because I could leave him in the school and, you know, that he would do okay, but I wasn't willing to risk that. And so my husband and I decided that, you know, private tutoring was the way to go.
And that made a difference.
Oh, a huge difference. Yep. He was grade level fairly quickly, and he just needed extra support and confidence with his reading. But it was really the tutoring that really helped him along.
Could I interject something here? Mm. I happen to write some articles in the past about this mm-hmm. problem. Do you happen to know what the tutoring, how was it different from what went on in the classroom with reading?
It's structured literacy. In the dyslexic world, we'd call it Orton-Gillingham-based methodology, which is it's structured, explicit, it's cumulative in its approach. So when you're looking at a child, each lesson is very much the same. The child knows what to expect. It's explicit. You don't rely on the child to just assume that this is the certain sound. You have to be very specific about the details in the English language, and goes from being something fairly basic and building up to more complex structures of the English language. So it's a very structured approach to mm-hmm. it.
And Orton-Gillingham, I know a little bit about it, was actually developed at the University of Iowa.
Yeah.
And I have had my own personal family concerns with reading challenges, not necessarily labeled dyslexia, but Orton-Gillingham method has been beneficial to a variety of reading challenges.
Right. And I think that's the thing about it, is that when you look at Orton-Gillingham or structured literacy, it doesn't just help students with learning disabilities or dyslexia. It helps all students become stronger spellers and stronger writers.
And we use it in the schools, right?
No. Hopefully, things are changing slowly. I mean, it's not going to help my kids, but I think, you know, in the future, and I don't know how close that future is, but I think it'll be.
Yeah. But you discovered more than your first child.
Yeah, so all three of our kids have dyslexia, and I kind of hoped that once we had figured things out for Matthew that it would be easier for my other two. And it was the same, you know, my middle child, Jessica, she, again, wasn't discrepant enough from her peers. My youngest child, Ben, was discrepant enough from his peers, so he did receive special education. But there again, it wasn't specific for, I mean, they'll say that it's specific for his needs, but it wasn't specific for dyslexia. And so he still continued to struggle during special ed.
And so they also needed additional instruction outside of the school
day. Yeah, so, you know, at one point we had three kids doing 3 hours of tutoring 3 days a week.
At $45 an hour.
Plus an hour, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's expensive. And that's kind of how I have been persistent in change, is because who can afford that? No one can afford that. We could barely afford it.
Well, we did it and we couldn't afford it. But my thinking was, what's the point of saving for college?
Yeah, you're not going to get that.
If my child can't read now, now's the time to spend the money.
That's kind of how I felt too.
So I'm going to take a little break here to let everyone know that you're tuned to KHOI Community Radio 89.1. This is Local Talk and the monthly Ames Progressive Alliance program. And today we're continuing the conversation from last week's APA gathering, where we discussed literacy issues for children in the Ames Community School District. And our guest today is Helen Blitvich, who discovered dyslexia in her family and has been a major force in understanding and educating our community about how to tailor instruction to the specific needs of children with reading challenges.
Helen, I have a couple more questions. You've mentioned that you took on this at your own personal family expense in a public education system. But even besides having to spend money, which you were fortunately able enough to do, you also spent a lot of time. Can you talk a little bit about the time commitment that you had to put into your children's dyslexia?
So to start with, it was just time, as in me just investigating what it was all about and, you know, going and doing different courses and things like that. And then it became more just, you know, reading to them, encouraging them. It's emotionally draining for a family when you've got kids that are struggling, and when this part is so important in their education. And if they're struggling in reading, that means they're struggling across all, you know, a lot of other subjects as well. So, you know, the time was just, you know, getting them to their tutoring classes and, you know, taking up like things like summer. You know, we didn't get a chance to do a lot of things during the summer to, you know, family vacations and stuff, because we really felt that the summer, that 3 month period, they can go even further back. So our summer months were spent doing a lot of tutoring, and they didn't want to do that. You know, they would like to do tennis lessons, swimming, play with their friends, those sort of things. But our day was dictated by, you know, who was going to tutoring. And when you've got three kids doing 3 hours of tutoring in the morning, you're just ferrying kids back and forth.
Sounds like you had a job going.
It was
there.
Quite a job.
It was quite the job. You mentioned that your youngest child had qualified for special education. So I assume that, is it Ben?
Ben, yes.
Had an individualized education program through the AIMS schools?
Yes, that's correct.
And what was your experience with what I think is called the IEP process?
It was frustrating. You know, I think you almost have to be a lawyer to really understand how the process works. I didn't understand it, and to tell you the truth, I even struggle to understand it now. But he got his IEP. It was individualized, but again, you know, it took a while even to put dyslexia in there. I repeatedly asked for Orton-Gillingham or structured literacy sort of program. And in our district at the time, they didn't, and I'm not sure that they still, well, they kind of do, use a specific program. So I would ask for, you know, can we use like something like a Barton's reading, writing and spelling program or Wilson? And initially they said, no, we don't use those sort of programs. I then, by the end of second grade, they did decide that they would bring Wilson reading, writing and spelling program, which is specifically for dyslexic kids. But we had a whole summer to go through then, and it was just like, we need to do something. We can't afford for Ben to be behind, because he had made no gains whatsoever in special ed. He was still a year and a half behind by the end of second grade, so he was at a first grade reading level. And so we ended up, you know, hiring another tutor and doing Susan Barton's reading, writing and spelling program. They did train somebody over the summer to do the Wilson. This person only got 2 days training. They weren't certified in Wilson. The person training them wasn't certified in Wilson. So they couldn't teach it with fidelity. And I didn't feel like I had confidence that Ben was going to make any more progress with this program if it wasn't executed correctly.
Well, I fought this fight, and the program that we were given was called Corrective Reading.
Right.
Which you can tell by the name. Wasn't what I was looking for.
No.
Well, I can certainly understand from Helen's experience. I have been a lawyer, and sometimes I'm not sure I understand the IEP process. But the IEP is a written document that's developed for each public school child who is eligible for special education. It's supposed to be a team effort with the family and the school system, and needs to be reviewed once a year. It is a requirement of federal law under the American with Disabilities Act. So one of your children had an IEP, but two did not.
Right.
Was the experience in working with the schools different with the IEP, or did it make no difference?
I mean, I guess we got to gather as a group and discuss Ben more frequently. And, you know, I could call and say, you know, I'm not happy with his progress. We need to meet again. We need to change goals and things like that. So in that respect, it was, you know, it seemed like it was a team effort. But unless you've got the correct program in place, your child's not going to make any progress. There's no point in doing exactly the same stuff that they were doing in the classroom in special ed, because obviously it didn't work in the classroom, so it's not going to work in special ed. So it's, you know, it was just a struggle. And in the end, we just had to decide, you know, what did Ben need and what was going to be best for him.
Well, I think as a progressive issue, the issue of IEPs is an interesting one, because what I saw as a lawyer was that the IEP worked quite well for upper middle class families with a lot of time on their hands who could advocate for their children. But for those families who either didn't have the sophistication, the means, the time available, the IEP was kind of a false promise. And so as a member of the progressive community, I'm concerned that the IEP serve process and programs serve all our children, yeah. not just those whose parents have the means to make sure that the IEP is the best it can be.
And I think a couple issues arise out of that, and this was something we talked about when we had our gathering last week, and one is labeling mm-hmm. and the inability or unwillingness of a lot of people to have their children labeled. And I think right. I was there for a while myself, and then I realized, give him a label. I'll take any label. It doesn't even matter because it means that he'll get some services. And the IEP allows that structure to have those meetings and bring people in. And at some point I realized I'm the one running that meeting and mm-hmm. I get to yeah. decide. But that's also speaking to I knew how I learned how this process worked.
Right.
And there are a lot of kids who don't have the people like myself and my husband and your family who are there advocating, who are doing the research, who are learning about what might be available outside of the school or even be able to afford that sort of thing. When we were at Sawyer, there was an after-school program that was busting at the seams with kids who needed help reading. And some of them actually could read, but they were in socioeconomic situations that probably were putting them at risk of not being able to keep up their reading proficiency that they had gained. We have a lot of kids who need assistance. There was some talk of maybe this program was going to start up again. It's not even instructional reading. A lot of it is just listening to kids. So they're getting that encouragement that isn't available in their homes structures, and we have too many kids.
Yeah. For our listeners who are interested in IEPs, I did find a good resource at a website called www.greatschools.org. So that's greatschools.org. And if you go there and put IEP in the search box, you'll come up with some good information, good solid information.
Very good. So you have been a real force in educating our community. I actually went to an event that I didn't realize you had organized a while back at the Ames Public Library with that fellow who was from Hawaii.
Oh,
but
Ron Yoshimoto.
Maybe tell us a little bit about that and then also decoding dyslexia and what you're...
So, Ron, that was long. That was when I first kind of traveled down this road. And he was from Hawaii. I'd gone out to Colorado. I'd done this course, Orton-Gillingham base course. And I thought, oh, my goodness, he's the man. He needs to come out to Ames and help. So I spoke to our principal. And I said, you know, this guy, he's got what we need for all our kids. And I said, I'm going to try and bring him out and maybe we can get some teachers to go. And so he did come out and we couldn't get teachers to go at the time. It wasn't part of the district's philosophy or something. So we didn't have any teachers, but I had 20 parents and tutors that came to this class. He did the evening at the Ames Public Library. I think there was like 110
people. Yeah, you see, there were a lot of people.
It was one of the biggest events I'd had in a while there. Yeah. So that was the beginning of things. And then, you know, I was part of the International Dyslexia Association. I'd go to a lot of their meetings, and then Decoding Dyslexia popped up about I think it was 2011. It originally started in New Jersey. Some parents got together. They were on a train chatting on a way to some conference and realized that they all had something in common and that they were frustrated that their children weren't getting what they needed. And so then they started up this group. Got legislation passed in the first year, and I think it was just, and it was a definition of dyslexia in their law. And so everyone in other states was like, wow, if they can do that in New Jersey, we can do it, you know, in our own states. And so in 2013, a group started up here. I wasn't part of the founding group, but I came in sort of like 6-9 months later. Legislation was passed to define dyslexia in Iowa code. So that meant that schools could say dyslexia, because up until this point, we're a non-categorical state and you don't label kids. You're just, you know, service them for their specific needs. Labeling can, you know, put everybody in the same box. But in the case of dyslexia, we want that diagnosis because we know that there's specific things that can help students with dyslexia. So that's kind of what our group is about. We're trying to educate parents and families and teachers, universities. We're trying to legislate to get things changed, hopefully change how universities teach their teachers to teach reading, and just really become parents to become their own advocates for their kids. And we've been around since 2013. We have we've had a couple of conferences. We have little pop-up things like at the public libraries, movie nights, particularly in October because that's Dyslexia Awareness Month. We do a lot of promoting there and education.
And you have a support group?
We have a support group in Ames, and there's one in Des Moines as well. There's one up in Clarion. So that's, again, it's just parents together to help each other. We're not experts, but, you know, you just need to be able to speak to other people. What's your experience? How did you deal with this situation? Where can I go to get information? Those sort of things.
I think that's true about a lot of things with children who have challenges, is it's not written down anywhere. I know from my own experience, it's been just talking to people, and I learn about programs or how they interacted with the school district or the school to try and make some things happen.
Yeah.
But you said now there was legislation, and where are we in that?
So we had
process?
The definition. We had great conversations about the reading endorsement, license for reading endorsement. We found out that those teachers didn't have any knowledge about dyslexia or how to teach dyslexia, students with dyslexia. So we had a huge input in changing what was required to get that endorsement. So that just happened recently. And then we're also looking into seeing how we can get universities to change their practice so that teachers know more about dyslexia, how to teach it, know the science behind reading. You know, it's not just about our dyslexic kids. There's a whole language versus structured language and literacy and sort of really understanding how kids learn to read.
But we're on a bit of a tight timeline as this third grade holding back children is looming.
Right.
And how are we moving quickly enough to catch the students who have?
I mean, I think the students are being identified. We've got the FAST assessment, which is this decoding dyslexia, really in favor of this assessment because it really identifies students early in kindergarten and first grade, it identifies whether these kids are at risk. And that's when you're supposed to put into action what you need done so that they don't get to third grade and then be held back. So it's beginning to happen. A lot of schools are realizing that they're going to have a big summer program if they don't. And that means busing and food, you know, education and things, you know, food and teachers. So there's a lot involved in that.
So Helen and Victoria have children in the schools. I'll admit that I've reached the age where I don't. So tell us a little bit about that third grade.
We're the
hold
same
back.
Age. I say again? Sorry. Oh, maybe you could speak to that.
Well, so it came into effect. Well, it's not actually in effect, but the law is there saying that if a student is substantially deficient, and they use a different terminology now, but if a student is substantially deficient in reading at the end of third grade, then they'll either be held back or they will be required to do summer school. There are certain criteria or things that if they've already been held back a grade, that doesn't apply to them, so they don't have to be held back again. But there's certain criteria that if they meet, they don't have to do any of those things. So it's sad because a lot of these kids who are dyslexic, they're really bright students.
Yep.
It's not that they, you know, need any other assistance in other areas of their education. They just are struggling to read. And so it seems really unfair, and it actually doesn't really help them to hold them back, because if you're not going to change what your practice is, then that 1 year is not going to make any difference.
And we're throwing everyone in the same basket.
Right.
Because there are a lot of children, there's a good research that starting early and preschool helps a number of children with their ability to read. If you have dyslexia, it's having specialized reading instruction to make sure that you're not going to fall into that.
Well, and the thing is that, you know, what helps a child with dyslexia, like I said before, will help all students. So if you've got a really good, solid, structured literacy program in your kindergarten through second grade classes and even third grade, then you're going to see a smaller number of students that are going to struggle to read. And you'll be able to identify them early with the FAST assessment. And then you'll have things in place. So these kids, hopefully by the time they reach third grade, aren't going to be in that situation. But at the moment, I think the law actually comes in effect not at the end of this school year, but the end of the following school year.
Yes.
So our school district doesn't have anything in place right now. So they'll only have a year, 18 months at most, to get these kids up to speed. And I can't see that really happening in 18 months unless it's intensive instruction.
We're probably a lot further along because of you. Thank you.
Well, 18 months for a public bureaucracy is a very short, short period of time. So I understand that Decoding Dyslexia has a big event coming up in
Iowa. We do. This is really exciting. So this is our third conference, and each year it's got bigger and bigger and more stressful. So this year we are going to be down in Des Moines at the Maytag Scout Center Friday, September 30th and October 1st. We also have a student evening on Friday the 30th for students 9 years and up. And Friday's a teacher program. It's actually sold out. We have 160 teachers coming to our event. It's amazing. I'm just excited. There's so many teachers.
So they're coming from all over the state?
Yes, AEAs, different school districts. Actually, Ames has about 25 teachers coming, which is I'm really excited about. And then we have the student night, which is really a program just about the kids. We have Dr. Robert Frank from Illinois. He wrote The Secret Life of the Dyslexic Child. Brilliant speaker. And he really helps these kids feel comfortable in their own skin and that this is a good thing. You know, it doesn't matter that you've got dyslexia. There's other things that you're good at. And so he's going to really tune into those kids' as sort of strengths. And then on Saturday, we have Parent Day. We have Dr. Robert Frank as well coming that day. We have a dyslexia simulation. And with Dr. Robert Frank and Professor Birks, and they're, again, going to get the parents feeling like, you know, this isn't a bad thing. What can we do to really encourage our kids and be active and get the find their strengths? So it'll be a really great day. We've got plenty of space for parents. If you want to come, Decoding Dyslexia, we have a website, ddia.net. You'll find all the information there, how to register. And, yeah, it'll be 2 great days. I'm excited about it.
Well, I'm excited just listening. One of the things that the Ames Progressive Alliance wants to do is encourage people in our community to be actively involved in issues that matter both to them personally and to the community as a whole. And Helen, I can truly say that you exemplify kind of local activism that we like to see and that we want to see more of in our community. But I have a specific question for you. You've been active for a number of years now with your children on this special issue of dyslexia. Can you share with our listeners what this has meant to you personally to be involved both in something that impacts your family, but helps impact our community? You've spent a lot of time and you've put a lot of heart in it. Tell us what it means to you.
Well, I just want something. You know, I found that I could help my kids, and it just frustrated me to no end that there's so many kids out there that don't have parents that are advocates and or even understand or know where to go and get resources. And I was just like, how can this be? You know, why do I have to pay this pathway? This should have been paid years ago. So I just feel quite passionate that, you know, there's other kids out there that don't have a parent that can be an advocate for them. And I just think that if they aren't there, then something should change, that we should be able to get legislators or somebody out there to change things so that we don't have to be spending hours and hours, you know, advocating. It's taken a toll. You know, I wouldn't say a toll. I say that it's emotionally draining for our family. I'm constantly at this. And I would just like some time just to walk away and say, yep, we've got everything in place and my job is done. But I'm not sure that that's anytime soon.
Well, I admire your fire here. Is there anything you can share with our listeners, any technique maybe that you've learned as a local community activist that you think really works?
I think gather. Find people that are similar to you. Find people that have got the same concerns and then start, you know, have a coffee together. We just started with, you know, a few people having a cup of coffee and then meeting with legislators like and Senator Kornbach. We met up with him just at a coffee shop here in town and chatted with him. And you sort of start reaching out. You don't have to go straight down to the Capitol and knock on the governor's door. It's just starting out small and gathering a group of people with you that have a common concern and then go from there and see what resources you each can bring together and bring to the table and then move from there. But you just have to keep being persistent. It's not something that's going to happen overnight.
Well, we'll keep talking because this is something that the Ames Progressive Alliance obviously is interested in. And The whole idea is to bring different community members together and figure out how we make our community better. So thank you very much. Once again, the time has gone by very quickly. And I just want to finish up by asking our listeners to keep up with the Ames Progressive Alliance activities on our Facebook page, Ames Progressive Alliance. You can get a copy of this radio show and follow the latest developments, such as the Ames Community Solar Initiative. That's also frequently posted on our Facebook page. Upcoming events for us include a volunteer day, work day at the Food at First Garden, which is directly behind the Trinity Christian Reformed Church on Ontario. They'll be preparing the plot for winter. That's going to be on Sunday, October 2nd, from 1 to 4, and it's followed by a potluck. So there's no better way to spend a fall afternoon, and we hope to see you there October 2nd, 1 to 4. Also, it is, as you may have noticed, election season, and there are some important local decisions. First, I just want to mention that on Thursday, September 29th, in-person voting starts at the auditor's office in Nevada at the County Administration Building. Also, there are several opportunities to learn more about state legislative and Story County Board of Supervisor candidates. I just have a few of them here, but you can go to the web pages of candidates to find out what's what the various opportunities are. On the 29th, the League of Women Voters will have a forum from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Council Chambers in Ames City Hall on October 4th. And that's the 29th is for state legislative candidates. And on the 4th, the League of Women Voters will be hosting a forum for county supervisor candidates, and that will be at the Ames Public Library. And then, of course, remember that on November 8th, that's Election Day, and our democracy depends on your vote. So thank you to our host, KHOI Community Radio 89.1, and our guest, Helen Blitvich, today. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And Helen, would you like to give our listeners a website or contact information how they can get in touch with you or with Decoding?
Probably Decoding Dyslexia. So we have a Facebook page. So Decoding Dyslexia Iowa has a Facebook page with, I think, so like 3,000 likes on it so far. And we also have a website, so ddia.net.
ddia.net.
Or Decoding Dyslexia Iowa.
I see, yes.
Okay.
And what about and we'll put that on our webpage,
too. What about the support group, if people want to get hold of you there?
So we have a support group. It's usually the second Saturday of each month. We meet at the Ames Public Library at 9:30, and it's usually in the Danfoss room. Sometimes I forget to book the room, so you might want to ask at the desk. But, yeah, it's the second Saturday of every month from 9:30 till
Sunday.
Saturday.
Second Saturday.
Yeah, from 9:30 until about 11.
Okay. Well, this has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm your host, Kay Potter. We've just been hearing about important literacy issues from the members of Ames Progressive Alliance and from Helen Blitvich of Decoding Dyslexia, which is an organization of parents and volunteers concerned about issues of reading difficulty. Earlier, we heard from Marcus Johnson, the owner of the Mucky Duck British Pub here in Ames, and also from people and their dogs on the patio there. The Mucky Duck now welcomes well-behaved dogs and their owners on their outdoor patio. Local Talk's theme music is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. Or just drop by the studio at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames. We'll always be welcome. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. This show was engineered by Evan Taylor. You can also listen to this show and all our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. You'll find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. And after a short while, it will be in the archive of shows on our website, which are also easy to find. And KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. And now stay tuned for Morning Masterpieces. And please remember that you, as listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. And now, thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.